From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
There's now enough clothes on the planet to clothe the next six generations. So just the volume of stuff is mind-blowing. And what we're trying to do is have charity shops not only say get the right value for that stuff, but actually sell the volume.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Ronan O'Dolig, founder and CEO of Thriftify, a social enterprise on a mission to bring the world's charity shops online. Thriftify's software platform enables charity shops to accurately value the donations they receive, such as books, clothing, jewellery, and everything in between. Charity shops can then use Thriftify to sell these goods online, thereby increasing their sales volumes and ultimately the return to the causes that they support. In this conversation, Ronan talks about starting a business straight out of college, how he went about raising $500,000 in seed funding, and the huge opportunity that Thriftify is pursuing across charity retailing, sustainable fashion, and climate change. I started out by asking Ronan to explain what Thriftify does in his own words.
Thriftify is an e-commerce social enterprise, and basically what we're trying to do is create a technology solution for the charity retail sector. So that's charities who operate shops across Europe, really, and the UK now. And our technology enables them to value their donations, of which there are hundreds of millions, from clothes, books, jewellery, and everything you can imagine, to value them and to sell them online, where they can sell more volume and sell them at a higher price point as well.
And how does it differ from something like Shopify, or is it quite similar?
It's very different, because, you know, what we've recognized is the problem that we're solving is quite different. So, you know, most online retailers are selling high volumes of the same SKU or the same product, whereas in the used goods space, there's only one of everything, and it requires a completely different approach. You know, you need to be merchandising that product differently, you need to be managing inventory differently, you need to be managing pricing differently. The whole thing is a different problem. And not only that, but especially, you know, for charity retailers, the online environment is very, very new. So for a lot of people who are maybe running a business, they might have already engaged in something online, and maybe they're looking to upscale or, you know, improve what they're doing. But actually, the charity retail sector, for a lot of charity retailers, they're very, very time poor. So it's an incredibly busy environment. So what we've had to do is build a solution that is very unique to a specific problem. And, you know, what we hear from the charities that we're working with is that the other platforms that they've used just don't solve the problem that they have. So we're very problem focused.
How did you come across that problem in the first place?
Just anecdotally, you know, I've always shopped in charity shops, and I picked up a book in a charity shop for €1 and that I needed for college, and researched that and found it was £60 on Amazon, and realized, you know, if there's this one book that's that cheap, and they're losing that much money on it, how many more are there? And then I think, you know, the real kind of motivation then came from the growth of sustainable fashion and the potential of having really, really big impact as well. So, you know, if we're able to get more and more people shopping not only used products, which has an amazingly sustainable impact, you know, fast fashion industry accounts for 10% of all global emissions, which is enormous. So we can have an enormous positively impact environmentally, but then our spend is going towards organizations that are using that for very good causes. So, you know, I don't shop on Amazon, and it's not because Amazon isn't a good service. It's probably the best service out there, but I don't shop on Amazon because of how they treat their staff, their workers, their reputation, the fact that they don't pay tax. So, you know, what we're trying to do is build a platform where people can say, not only am I being sustainable, but actually my money is going to the best causes in the world.
Talk to me about the kind of social aspect of it, because it's a social enterprise. And I suppose, I don't think you'd be doing this particular thing if it didn't have that that element to it. So how did you decide, or was it an inspiration? Have you always had desire to kind of do something good in the world?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like I come from a part of Dublin called Clondalkin that would be, well, Clondalkin's a great place. I come from a working class part of Clondalkin called Bonog, which would be very deprived and disadvantaged, and has been for a long time. And I think I just kind of was always instilled with, there are a substantial number of people in society who just don't have opportunities. And the kind of myth that you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps, which was a joke of a phrase that was literally invented because it's impossible to do, you know, it's just not something that sits well with me. And I've always just felt that if you're going to invest a huge amount of time and effort into a business, that it should be something that's fulfilling, first of all, but it also should be something that's meaningful and is really solving a problem. So, you know, I've always loved entrepreneurship and I've always tried around with different things and have always been buying and selling something. And I think, you know, this was kind of the opportunity where I said, actually, this is the best of both worlds. This is something that potentially is can be very, very impactful and meaningful, but is also, you know, a really good business challenge. So it was kind of marrying those two things together for me was the sweet sauce.
So take me back to the when you first got the idea as such. How did you go about testing the idea and how did you go about launching the business?
Yeah, it was, it's been a very, very slow process, really. You know, it was kind of, I had the idea and needed to validate it. So we just did it very iteratively. I got a load of secondhand books from a charity shop. I said, you know, can you give me a pallet of secondhand books and I'll value them and see if this concept is, there's anything in that. And that the data from that proved really fruitful. I valued them on Amazon and other retail sites and I saw that the value was way more. And then we just took it step by step from each stage. You know, I was doing it part-time in my spare time. And just over time, we've replicated that. And even now that we're on a really big scale, we still do that with every new idea or new challenge. We seek to validate it first and then engage new partners or existing partners in the beta version of what we've built and get their feedback and improve it.
So do the items become more expensive being sold through Thriftify, allowing the charity shops to make more money essentially and to raise more funds for their charity?
It's a mixture. So, you know, we do get that a bit of criticism, you know, from the bargain hunters who say, guys, I was going to the charity shop looking for the Louis Vuitton handbag for 20 quid. And our pushback is, well, that handbag is worth 150 quid and the charity shop is down 130 quid. So what we're trying to do is create an opportunity for the charity shops to sell the things that are worth money, because fundamentally that's why they exist. You know, charity shops have always played a dual role. The first and priority has been to raise funds to achieve their social mission on the side. So whether that's housing people, whether it's providing support to the elderly or whatever it is, they need to raise finance to do that. And that's what charity shops exist for. But then on the other end, you do have a very important role in society, which is to provide goods for people from lower income backgrounds. So that's also a really important role. And we in no way want to be kind of satisfying one to take away from the other. So what we are doing is selling those branded products for the value that they have. And we believe that's the right thing to do. But then what we also do is we're helping them to sell a lot more volume. And this is really where, at the moment, things are very interesting for us, because the volume of donated goods is just enormous. It's so big that you couldn't sell it even if there was five times the amount of charity shops on the high street. It's that big. And it's kind of been driven by the consumerist mentality and the fast fashion industry. So we've gone from having three seasons or four seasons a year in fashion to having 52. And there's now enough clothes on the planet to clothe the next six generations. So just the volume of stuff is mind-blowing. And what we're trying to do is help charity shops not only get the right value for that stuff, but actually sell the volume. So, you know, we're selling lots and lots of stuff for cheaper price points. And I think that's really exciting as well, because it challenges the idea of fast fashion. Because what we're saying is, you know, you don't need to go to the big fashion high street brands who are producing in the millions, you know, using polyester, which is oil. You're literally, you know, you go into a fast fashion high street shop and you're buying oil is what you're doing. You know, you wouldn't go to Shell and say, can I have 100 quid of oil? So, but that's what we're doing on a massive scale. So what we're saying is you don't need to do that, because there's every type of clothing and everything you can possibly imagine already exists. And what we need to do is just make that circular. So you find someone who already has it, or most likely it's in a charity shop, you buy it and you donate it back again. And then you keep buying it and donating. And if we can develop that circular model, it just ceases the demand for new production and, you know, the negative consequences that come with that.
So I think you've a very good understanding of the problem and how you're trying to solve it. Throughout the kind of over the years since you've started the business, I suppose you've had to learn loads of other things like freight and shipping and all these other things that go into building an e-commerce platform. How have you dealt with that kind of since starting, and how much have you learned since starting out the business?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And probably the truth of it is, you know, 90% of what we know now, we didn't know when we started. That's across the whole remit of everything, you know, the whole remit of the e-commerce world, the shipping and fulfillment world. I think that that's fundamentally the entrepreneurial experience, is you're consistently engaging in deepening your understanding of a problem, deepening your understanding of the solution, and deepening your understanding of how to make product market fit. You think you have a problem, but does it meet where the market is currently at? And both of those things are constantly changing. So, you know, it's not about, I think what we've learned is it's not about finding the answer, building the solution and stepping away from it. It's actually getting into that learning process and that iterative process of being really close at all times to the problem, to the market, to trends, and to your own solution. So our solution this year, for example, we'll spend more than we've spent since we started on our technology. And that would probably be the same every year into the future, because you need to be consistently investing in what you're doing and in solving the problem. And as I said, you know, making that product, finding that product market fit. So, you know, there's been a huge amount we've learned. I think we've developed enormous expertise in some areas, and I think that's been really, really beneficial. So one of the things we learned early on was that we would have to cater for the full e-commerce experience for our users. So it wasn't good enough for us to just provide a valuation tool or just to provide an online selling tool. What we had to do was provide the full remit from valuation straight through to fulfillment and everything in between, merchandising, imagery, the whole lot. That was one of the biggest learnings we had, which meant we then had to go and build a really good solution. And like, our technology now at the moment is automatically handling the fulfillment, which the model is so innovative that we've built, like, that we're having conversations with fulfillment partners that they've never had before. You know, they're like, we haven't done this ever from a technology perspective. And we were like, yeah, well, you need to do it for us because our users need it. So it's put us in a position where the technology that we've built is very, very powerful. So I wouldn't look at it, you know, in the early days, you kind of think, oh, Jesus, I don't know anything about this. I have to go and learn about it. I wish I could just do the thing I know. But actually, the more you invest, I think, in really, really deeply understanding the problem and deeply understanding the solution and working towards solving that, the more beneficial it is, it's going to be for you, because you put the business in a place where you're able to do things that other people just aren't, you know, and you're able to build something that really, really works.
How much of the technology do you understand in terms of how it's built and that side of the business?
We have a CTO, Rahil, who is our head of platform, basically, and he makes the kind of final calls on the platform. But I would be very heavily involved in absolutely everything around the platform, because we're a tech company and tech is our product. So, you know, if you're not close to the product as a founder, you know, what are you doing? So I would be very, very heavily involved. I would understand pretty much every single aspect. You know, I wouldn't be able to tell you how the code works or how the modules integrate with each other or from a technical perspective. But in terms of the functionality, I have a complete understanding and would be very actively involved in deciding the roadmap and deciding the new features. And it's very important, I think, that the full team and, you know, whoever's captaining the ship is very, very closely on top of that and saying, you know, I see why you want to take it this direction, but over on this angle, we have this demand from a customer who's 5 times bigger than anyone we've ever dealt with, and they want to take it in this direction. And, you know, those kind of conversations are crucially important, and you have to understand the tech if you want to have them conversations.
Yeah, like, I suppose, is there ever a desire for new features from yourself that you discuss with the CTO and he's kind of saying, that's going to be impossible, are too expensive, are, you know, X, Y, and Z? Does that happen often in this situation?
In fairness to the team, we never say anything is impossible and we never say it's too expensive. We say, this is how hard it's going to be and this is how much it's going to cost. And then we say, are we up for that challenge and do we have enough money to build that? I think you kind of have to take the emotion out of it a bit as well and say, you know, for example, we would have built, you know, when we were building our technology integration, we had that conversation and we said it's too hard. Initially, we said it's too hard and it costs too much. And then we said, well, do we have a business without this? And the answer was no. So then we said, so then fundamentally our approach changed as well. We have to do this. So therefore it said, how do we, this, instead of becoming how big of a challenge is this, it says, how do we achieve this? And I think that's how we've kind of learned to approach all of the tech now. It's very much, what is the priority in terms of tech and how do we achieve it? You know, so for example, actually, we're having a big conversation now at the moment around pricing, right? Because we started out on barcoded products and we were able to build very good algorithms to automatically value those products, because you can plug a barcode into multiple online databases, even directly into Amazon, and retrieve hundreds of lines of information about that product, from the demand, price point over time, everything. So we have an algorithm that does that for barcoded products. But for non-barcoded products, it's next to impossible to do that, right? You kind of have to compare the brand or the image to, you know, if you take a picture of a Louis Vuitton handbag or a designer dress or whatever it is, there's no barcode. There's no uniformity with that. There might be a manufacturer's barcode, but that's, you can't do anything with that because it's gatekeep. It's, you know, it's, it doesn't, even if you could get access to the Zara database, it's not any good. All you know is how much they were selling it for. You don't know how much anyone else is going to sell it for. So it's an enormous problem. And one of the things we've said recently is that's something that we have to solve. And we're at the stage now, we've no idea how we're going to solve it, but we've made it that we have to solve this, because if we want to be able to do huge volumes of used goods, we have to be able to provide a spot on price for used unbarcoded products, because we won't be able to do volume otherwise. Because you have to take, at the moment, it just takes too long to do the research. It's guesswork. We're not really close to the consumer price point. Now, we do have a process for how we do it and it's working. But if we want to get to the volumes that we have and the ambition that we have to build a solution for that. So that's kind of the way we approach it, is we kind of say, is this something that we want to take on? And if it is, then we just go and do it. So we're in that research phase now. We're looking at, what is everybody else doing? What's available on the market? What do we have that other people don't have? And how is it going to solve our users' needs? And that's, I actually love that process. You know, it's kind of creative. It's really challenging and it's really entrepreneurial. So I think the team actually gets really excited by those kind of challenges, which is great. Instead of looking at them as, oh, damn, you know, this is something that's bigger than we can chew off. We actually look at them as, great, let's get our teeth into this and really build something exciting.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. I suppose you've probably had challenges with having funds to take on some of these challenges that you've been talking about. How did you go about raising the capital?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the biggest challenge, and it still is a big challenge. So, you know, when we started out, we were just chasing as much grant finance as we could, and no one was on a salary for years because we just couldn't afford it. And it's something that doesn't sit really well with me. It's kind of, you know, if you're someone from a background like mine where you don't necessarily have, now I was very lucky because I left college and set up another business, which I'd done well. You know, I was able to do things in a way that freed me up more so than a lot of other people can. And I think it's one of the misnomers of entrepreneurship, you know, that anybody can be an entrepreneur. Whereas actually, if you have access to capital and if you have access to parental support or whatever it is, the more money you have, the easier it is to set up a company. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, we definitely struggled for 2 or 3 years where we just couldn't get the money we needed. We were getting grants here and there. We were plugging it in. We were trying to gradually build a solution bit by bit. But, you know, Rahil was doing things, our CTO, in his spare time, and just the progress wasn't there. And it came to the point where we said, look, what we need to do is iteratively grow this and start bootstrapping it more effectively and getting really focused on the commercials of this and stop waiting for the magic finance to come in. So, you know, we just really doubled down on sales and really doubled down on the sales volume and recruiting new charity shops and really trying to pitch it and get new people on board. And thankfully that gradually started to pay off, primarily not actually in the commercials, because we actually don't earn a lot. The vast majority goes to the charity shops, obviously. But actually what it demonstrated to funders was actually there's traction and this thing has taken off. So it was that kind of chicken and egg scenario. And then luckily, we gradually started getting to a stage where we kind of felt we're very serious about this. The team is really solid. Let's go and raise seed finance. So we went to the market. We had gotten Enterprise Ireland support, and it took us about a year then to raise our seed round. So we raised 500 grand in a seed round, which closed last year. And that's really helped us to kind of, really solidify our position in Ireland and get ready for international launch. So it's been great. And I think the lesson is, you know, even though we have that now, it sounds like a lot, but the reality is it's really, really not, especially for a tech startup. We could spend that in 3 months if we wanted, and it would be spent really well. But obviously we can't do that because we're not, you know, we wouldn't grow fast enough to be in it. We'd run out of money basically. So what you kind of have to do then is the same process. You're kind of looking at, where are we spending money? How do we save money? Where do we cut costs? How do we stay really, really lean? And how do we leverage the supports that we can get? So, you know, we've gotten great supports from, we have AWS, we're on their Activate program, which means our hosting is almost pretty much paid for. We've leveraged grants from multinationals for, you know, Google Ads, for all kinds of stuff. And we've really gone after that because we felt this is going to really help us stay lean and bootstrapped. Yeah, thankfully that's worked. And I think it's great that we've been doing it for so long. It's kind of in our DNA now. You know, we really don't spend a penny on anything we don't have to. And you'll notice, you know, because I fought with you over it when I don't know how much we were paying. And I gave you probably 6 weeks of headaches when you forced you to cut your costs. And it's the same. Everybody gets that same stick. You know, everybody we speak to who wants money out of us gets the same really, really tough negotiation. And it's kind of, it started out that way because we absolutely had to do it. We didn't have a choice. And, you know, I think that as a startup, that's very important, that you're kind of a little bit tight. Yeah.
What's the pitch to an investor? You know, explain the opportunity to me.
Yeah, well, there's two things for us. I mean, the first thing that's always been there for me personally has been, do you want to do something meaningful, genuinely meaningful? And whether you're an investor or whether you're someone who just likes the idea, that's where I always go back to, is we have an ambition to do something that's incredibly meaningful. And if it works, it's going to be one of the most impactful fashion plays that we've ever seen. So that's our genuine ambition. And that's what we're saying to people is, you know, you might have invested in other things, or you might have supported other things, and that's great. Do you want to do something genuinely meaningful? And if you do, then let's have a conversation. And we've no interest really in dealing with people who just want to make money. We don't want them on our team. We want people who are genuinely committed to impact, because that's what our DNA is. And so we were quite picky with the people we brought on board. You know, we could have maybe raised sooner, and probably that would have been a better commercial decision. But the team just felt that we have to have people who believe in the same meaning that we do. There's two things. The first is what's happening in the market. So there's no doubt in my mind that there's going to be a Just Eat of fashion. There's going to be a Ryanair of used fashion, I should say. And, you know, the demand for used fashion is increasing massively. And I think fast fashion we're at the very, very early stages of the cracks in its foundation. And there's a very strong chance that it's going to come crumbling down. And it's driven by the reality of physics. And the reality of physics is, you put carbon in the atmosphere and the planet gets warm. And now what scientists are telling us is, okay, guys, if we don't stop doing this, there's a very high likelihood of an extinction level event. You know, you can't fight the physics, and the physics are, people are learning this. People are realizing that when I go and spend a fortune on fast fashion that's been produced using oil and is contributing one of the biggest contributions in the CO2 emissions, pollution, microplastic pollution, terrible workers' rights. I mean, it's one of the worst industries out there. It's literally the same as the oil industry. And that word is spreading. And for young people who are incredibly engaged, you know, very well educated, the most educated generation ever, probably, they're learning about this and they're saying, I'm not taking part. I'm not going to be in that. No thanks. It's not for me. And that's an enormous challenge to the fashion industry. And what it means is that new models are taking off. So whether that's your Depops, you know, even eBay is experiencing a big resurgence. And our fundamental position is, yeah, we have everything that they have, but we also have the extra secret sauce is all of the money has gone towards good causes, which nobody else is competing with. So that's a big factor. And then the other factor, I think, is the reality of building an enterprise is you need to keep the lights on. You need to be able to reinvest and you need to be able to grow. And you do that by eventually taking in more money than you're spending. So we have a commercial model like any other tech startup. And what we're able to demonstrate using data is that if this works, it's going to be really, really successful. So, you know, we've put over 3 million valuations through our technology. And we were able to, in the same way that physics says one thing about the climate, our data is science and it says one thing about our growth and what's going to happen if we keep going the way we're going and the commercials that. So we definitely rely on a mixture, I suppose, of a very big vision, but also backing that up with incredibly powerful data, which, you know, any data analyst can go through and say, oh, these guys are actually telling the truth here because the data says so. And I think for us as a startup, that's incredibly important. But I actually think, you know, I think it's a very important conversation in general, because recruiters now and major corporations are struggling to recruit the same talent. And it's because young people have a very, very strong urge to do something that's meaningful and to spend their 9 to 5, if it's a 9 to 5, doing something that they feel is meaningful. And I think it's something that in general, business has not caught up with at all. You know, we know that that's the case for the climate, because scientists wouldn't be screaming at us if it was. But I think the same thing is true for young people, that business needs to now be responsive to a really, really rapidly developing trend in how young people engage in society and business.
What is it, do you think, that makes you think so big about these things, for want of a better expression? You know, I think if someone was kind of passionate about these things, they might start a thrift shop, or they might do something else kind of on a smaller scale, and they tend not to kind of look too far outside of what they've seen before. What do you think it is that has made you go after the bigger opportunity and to try and build Thriftify into this huge thing that could solve this massive problem?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think there's multiple things in it. The first thing I would say is when I started, I had no idea that it could be as big as I now think it is. So, and I think that's true for a lot of entrepreneurs, is you start something that you think might work. And if you stick with it long enough and you're persistent, and if your gut feeling stays the same, which is that actually, I think there's a problem here, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. You believe it more and more, you pull in more support, they start to believe it, everybody starts to believe it, and it starts to kind of gain a momentum of itself, which then pulls you on further. So, you know, it hasn't been like this since day one. It wasn't me stepping out of my college dormitory and saying, I'm going to go and do this and it's going to be huge. So that's important to say. But I think now and over the past few years, you know, I think there's two aspects of it. From a personal perspective, I think the Carl Sagan philosophy of literally this is a blip in time and then your existence is over forever is something that I think motivates me to get up and do something. Like if you're going to do something and if you're going to spend a huge amount of energy at something, why not do it to the biggest it can be done? Either it takes off or it's a glorious failure, but at the end of the day, you still have a great story, you know, and it's just more enjoyable. So I think that's a big motivational aspect now from a personal perspective is just a why not, you know, go for it and do it. From the kind of business perspective, it's really, really the team. You know, we've just had a lot of conversations and all of our team, you know, is under 35. We were all under 30 at one stage. we're all under 35. And it's one of the things we've spoken about very frankly is, you know, our team all come from, some of them from very high power backgrounds, hugely experienced and also incredibly diverse, you know. So the majority of our team are international. So just a really, really diverse team. And one of the things we've spoken about is, do we genuinely believe we have the skills to do this as a team? And do we genuinely believe that the model we're developing has the potential? And every single time we really play devil's advocate and we really push that out, the answer is always yes. The answer is always, we have the ability to do this and we owe it to ourselves to really go and do it. And I think that's probably maybe the single biggest lesson I've learned over time. For the first 2 years, I did it myself and was burnt out and resented it. And then, you know, when I started to get a team on board, I realized actually, why the hell hadn't I done that from day one? And if I could go back or give any advice to anybody, it was don't ever start something on your own. because the isolation of it, the challenge of it, and just it's just not as much fun. So I think the biggest aspect now is the fact that we have a team in place who developed a culture of high ambition and high performance.
How have you found the team members? I suppose you're looking for people that share the same values and can get behind the same mission. Was it difficult to find the team members that wanted the same things as you?
Yeah, no, it actually wasn't. And it's one of the things I maybe get slagged on a little bit, because people find it very, very hard to recruit co-founders. And for me, I was just really, really lucky. I put an ad up online for a CTO and two people responded. One of them is the CTO and one of them is the COO. They were the only two people that responded to the ad and they were perfect. So it was just pure fluke. You know, Gary said this to me on the Entrepreneur Experience podcast, which is when chance meets opportunity, hard work meets opportunity, I think.
I know the phrase. Preparation or something.
Preparation means opportunity. And I have kind of, from my college days, have consistently tried to go and meet new people and put myself in places where I could learn stuff. So, you know, if that was a debate in the college student society, I'd go and chat to people, or I'd go and meet people, or if there was an event on in town or a networking group or whatever it was, I invested a huge amount of time just going and trying to experience new things and put myself in situations that I thought were interesting or that I was genuinely interested in. And I think that has reaped dividends, which I didn't foresee. You know, I was purely doing it because I wanted to learn stuff and I thought they were interesting. But actually, you know, over time, you end up building a network of people that you can say, oh, actually, Jay-Z, I remember meeting that guy or this girl at that event and they would be good for this thing. Or, you know, and I really do think that that's incredibly important. Now, it's much harder to do now because obviously you can't meet anybody. There is no events. But even before COVID and the lockdowns, you know, just the amount of time we have to spend on the company has been more and more. So unfortunately, I don't get to do as much networking as I kind of used to. But in the early stages, I would be maybe at least two events a week and talking to maybe 20, 30 people, new people a week, and following up with maybe one or two of those people who I thought just were interested in or who I got on with or felt there might be an opportunity there in the future. And I do think that's incredibly important and it can reap huge dividends.
So it's a long game, really. I mean, with networking, it sounds kind of like a dirty word, but it's really about meeting people like that, and kind of by osmosis, then you have people to call on when you need them.
I think there's a lot of the startup and corporate world that I find repulsive, to be honest, in some ways. And it's, you know, sometimes you go to events and they're the stickiest corporate, bloody boring event, and nobody actually leaves wanting to talk to anyone who they've met at the event. I've experienced that so many times, you know, and you kind of have to bait a bit of crack out of the event. You're kind of trying to find people who you can, Jesus, like, come on, like, networking is the most boring phrase. What we're actually here for is to genuinely express the things we're interested in and see if that's reciprocated by anybody. That's what it's about. So I think as well, you kind of have to be, you know, I got a lot pickier about the stuff I would go to, and I would go to the softer stuff. You know, I wouldn't go to the, everyone's in a suit and there's a keynote speech for an hour and a half and you might get 20 minutes to chat at the end. I was, you know, what's the point? I'll just watch it online. You know, I was going to stuff where it was, you know, you're going to talk to 40 people and it's going to be a bit of crack and it's not too formal, because I think ultimately, you know, if you are networking, if you are spending your time at that, it should be enjoyable, you know, and it should be a genuine expression of these are the things I'm actually interested in and the things that I'm enjoying, not kind of going into it for the sake of going to it, because you won't keep going. Like, you just, if you're doing anything for the sake, just because you think you need to do it, like, how much of a demotivator is that? I think you have to kind of go to stuff that you find, actually, I'm really interested in this topic, therefore I'm going to go to this event.
You said you started a business directly out of college. What business was that?
Yeah, so it was in the social enterprise kind of impact space. So I started loads of different projects, and from a young age, like even in school, I was buying and selling second mobile phone parts. So, you know, this was when mobile phones took off. I was buying memory cards and cases in bulk and selling them in my school, and then in a few other schools as well. And then when I left, so I'd always been interested in loads of different things, and probably too many things for a long time. And then when I left college, I had spent most of my time in college organizing events and being involved in societies and extracurricular stuff, because that's what I was interested in. And then I set up an event management company called Impact Events. And the model was that we would help charity groups, community groups, and people. This was, again, straight out of the recession where you know, community and voluntary sector was decimated. And I said, I've a bunch of skills in how to run large scale events. So we'll go and we'll help your community organization or your charity run the event based on the resources that you have, but without any investment. So you have maybe an email database of 20,000 people, you have a massive event venue, but you don't know how to leverage those things. So we'll come in, come up with the idea, organize the event, run it, and take our costs out of organizing it for you. And a lot of those events then turned into regular, consistent weekly events. So dances and bingo events and all kinds of stuff. And what we then did after that was kind of started to recycle the money we were making from that into new projects and new events and new ideas for, again, more social enterprises. And that's always kind of been at the key, kind of at the core of my interest in entrepreneurship as well, is, you know, instead of the idea of making lots of money to be able to go and retire in the Algarve or something, it sounds nice, but it's not something I'm very interested in. I think, you know, the idea for us has always been, if you can make money and reinvest it in those communities like Bonog or in those communities that haven't had investment, the impact of that is enormous. And I think then it kind of, yeah, it's just kind of about changing how we look at entrepreneurship. And instead of entrepreneurship being a kind of an extractive process where it's constantly about the bottom line and constantly about making more money, it actually becomes about impact. And what happens at the bottom line is, instead of that money being sent offshore or going into someone's pocket, it's reinvested in something really impactful. So all of the money for that, from that event management business was reinvested in other community events and community projects, other startup enterprises, social enterprises, and all kinds of things.
Have you found it difficult at all to decide what you should take from some of these businesses, or, you know, what you should pay yourself? If it's like, obviously you're trying to make the biggest impact that you can with the reinvested profits. Have you thought much about that, about, you know, what yourself and the team should get out of it?
Yeah, well, in the early stages, you know, and because everything we were doing was so charitable, you know, we've always had kind of the highest governance standards. We had a registered charity overseeing the event management company. So we stuck to really good standards across everything, and we've always maintained that. And even in Thriftify now, you know, we exceed the voluntary governance code, even though we're not a registered charity. Like, we're way, like, our financial policies and procedures, you know, and you will have helped with some of this, is something that we're aiming and have gotten absolutely ring tight, and something we've always improved. So it's always been something to the fore of our mind. And I think in this specific question, you know, in the early stages of entrepreneurship, the objective was the average industrial age. We kind of said, what's fair, what's a representation of our value, but also, you know, of the value we have and the work that we're doing, but also what's fair in terms of the mission, the social mission we have. So we always just aimed for the average industrial age. Most of the time we didn't make it, but that was what we kind of aimed for. And now it's a bit of a different question. So, you know, I think in the tech space and in the social enterprise space, it's an enormous challenge, because there's a market for technologists, right? So, you know, I can go to someone and say, I have this amazing impactful vision and it's going to change the world. And they say, great, I'm on 180 grand. And I say, I'll give you 35. And they say, and I'll say, and the rest you can get in goodwill about the work you're doing. And they kind of say, no, thanks. So that's the reality of tech, right? Yeah. So, you know, I did try that and it didn't work. So you kind of have to find that balance, you know, and you kind of have to say, to those individuals who are able to command that and, you know, have a family to raise and all the rest, you're going to have to be realistic about it and try and find the middle ground and say, right, we're going to pay as much as we can. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be what you were used to, but these are the other benefits you get. And this is what else we can do. So, you know, in Thriftify, for example, we have a completely flat structure and everybody, it's like a democracy. So everybody is involved in absolutely everything. You know, everybody has a stake in the business, everybody is really actively involved, and the company is totally flat. So we're bringing people into something that they do have to take. Everyone takes a bit of a drop at the moment. That's the reality of startup entrepreneurship. But I think, you know, we kind of then, yeah, it's just about that balance, really. It's about trying to say, look, this is the max we can afford in this role, and how can we find the right person who appreciates that and is happy to take a risk on something and is happy to come on board for the sake of maybe having a big impact down the road. So it's really tricky, and it's really difficult, not just for, you know, it's really difficult for a normal startup, but it's, I think it's even more difficult for a socially driven startup.
Yeah, like I think you said it earlier, when you're trying to get other people involved and you're inspiring them about a mission, you know, a lot of young people now don't want to do something that doesn't have meaning. You know, they all do want to do something with a social aspect. And the reality is that, you know, there's a trade-off there as to you know, where the money is going and where the funds are going to and who they're helping.
There's a kind of an evangelization of charity wages, you know, and it's always in the news. It's always kind of, the charity CEO is being paid 120 grand. Isn't that absolutely scandalous? And I can see where that's coming from, because people automatically assume, well, that money could have been going to the cause, right? And there's an element of truth in that, but it kind of misses the bigger point, which is strategically how focused, what's the strategic plan for the return on social investment, right? So everyone talks about return on investment, but in the social space, and actually what everybody should be talking about is return on social return on investment, I should say. So let's say, you know, there's a charity is paying a CEO 80 grand and they say, actually, there's this candidate who, if we bring in, we believe is going to grow our impact, our commercial side of our revenue 10x, 5x, 2x. And we'll have to pay them 40 grand more. So maybe they bring in a new CEO and pay that CEO an extra 40 grand. But the CEO brings this contact base or this experience in this previous organization or whatever it is that takes the revenue for that charity up an enormous amount, which doubles or triples the impact. And I think that that nuance is just never spoken about. You know, we never really talk about that. And it doesn't really sit well with me. You know, we're happy to pay like the executive of the oil company or the executive of the computing gaming company that makes violent games that are directed at kids or whatever. We'll pay them whatever, right? And there's a little bit of controversy about it. But suddenly when we say, actually, this person is going to do incredibly amazing work and is going to try and revolutionize this problem, we say, oh, well, but don't pay them for it. And, you know, I do understand where it comes from, but I think we need to change the conversation a little bit around that and not have as much evangelization and just get a little bit more strategic and clever and talk about the fact that actually what we need is fundamental change in how the most wealthy people are getting paid, and not a kind of a poverty approach to people who are trying to do good work. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I suppose charities in general, and one of the problems they have is that it's sometimes hard to measure the impact of what they do. There tends to be a lot of waste in charities, or assumed waste, because it's just so hard to see what the impact is in certain aspects. But I suppose for a social enterprise, it kind of solves that problem, because your impact is measurable straight away, because it's kind of measurable on what's being reinvested and the impact you're having with all your customers.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think the exciting thing as well is maybe the conversation around the impact that's not being had that could be being had by the private sector. So, you know, we could say, let's have many more social enterprises, which would be great. But there's also this new conversation, which I think should be getting more steam, which is, what if we made it harder for big corporations, for example, to avoid paying tax? Or the next stage from that, what if we actually made it in the same way that hundreds of years ago, corporations were able to employ children and pollute rivers? Why don't we just completely start putting much more legislative pressure on large corporations to have more impact? So that could be very easily done. And, you know, the European Commission have recently said that large corporations need to start doing impact reporting. And I think that's a good first step. So you make massive corporations report on what social impact they're having. And then gradually you start to turn the screw on that and you say, well, that's good, but now we want you to have impact in this social area and in this environmental area and in this area and ABC. So I think the conversation needs to develop around it all a little bit.
What kind of books or resources have you followed throughout your journey? And even, I suppose, when you're in college, because this whole entrepreneurial thing tends to start much earlier than day one of the business. What resources have you lent on over that time?
The biggest thing, I think, has always been the individual actual mentorship and the people. I've had quite a very good board of mentors. A guy called Larry Quinn, who set up a company called Acuris Networks. Brian Caulfield, who's a successful VC as well, have been two guys who've been on the phone and available, not regularly, but a couple of times a year since I was a teenager, since I was in college, you know. And I kind of sought that out because I felt if I needed to learn something, if I had a problem, I wanted to be able to pick up the phone to people who could give me an answer that I really trusted and really felt held weight. So I've always kind of sought to do that. I've always kind of sought to reach out to experts and to people who I felt could provide a really good answer. And you'd be surprised, you know, I remember initially thinking, you know, these people are going to be asked all the time. There's probably 10 people asking them a day. Will they be their mentor? And there's not. They're really, because that's what everyone thinks, so no one asks. So, you know, I think that's been the go-to for me consistently. If there's a challenge or a problem or something I want to learn, I first of all go to people. I think the other aspect or books or stuff is definitely, it's a mixture for me. It's technical stuff and hard sciencey stuff that I'm really interested in. Recently, it's moved a lot into the environmental space. So that kind of hard science around what's happening to the climate, where it's coming from, the industry base, all that kind of stuff. And then the other side of it would have just been, this is probably something that I've learned more recently and should have done a longer time ago, was just more investment in the softer stuff and in the personal development and, you know, just taking it easy on myself and reading cheap fiction or reading, you know, whatever it was, or doing yoga or stuff like that. I think as an entrepreneur out of college, you kind of fall into the trap of the heropreneurship mentality of do 80 hours a week and never mind your well-being. Sure, no successful entrepreneur looks after himself, kind of nonsense. So I've definitely, thankfully, in recent years, veered towards more well-being literature and more kind of stuff around, actually, how do I take care of my own mind and body, and the company will take care of itself.
Did you meet your mentors? Did you meet them at events and things that you were at, and then kind of follow up with them? I know you said you sought them out, but how did that kind of happen?
So DCU, I was studying in DCU, and I met Larry through an event in DCU. And again, I got an invitation to an event because I was active in student societies and was at a dinner, and Larry was at the table and just had a really, really good conversation with him and similar backgrounds. And again, it was kind of, you know, what now, at the time, I'd say, God, that was very lucky. But actually looking back, you kind of realize, well, actually, you know, I got the invitation because I was doing that work or because I was extroverted and going and doing it. Yeah, it was kind of initially personal contacts. But I think then, you know, now it would be, because there's less of those opportunities for me. It's definitely the kind of the ask, you know, I'll ask someone who I think might know someone. And even if I only faintly know them, I'll ask them anyway, you know. So even if it's someone I'm working with or we've a business relationship with, I'll say, I'm trying to meet someone in this space. I think you might know anybody. Is there any chance of a bit of advice or help? And, you know, I love getting those emails. It's one of the things I love most is people asking me to do stuff for them, because you feel really valuable if you can help someone with something. So I think instead of I would have always, or maybe would have always looked at it as putting a burden on someone. But actually, personally, I really love getting asked to help people. So I would hope that the people I'm asking to help me, at the very minimum, they don't see it as a burden, but hopefully that maybe even they enjoy it, or that they feel, you know, that they've provided some value.
So what are the goals, this kind of near-term goals for Thriftify? And then I suppose let's talk about where you see it going over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the moment, you know, we have a big job to do to prove the commercial model. We've done very well in the Irish market, in the Irish space, in getting people on board and bought in. We're not yet up to the scale that we want to be at or the volumes we want to be at. So that's, you know, that's taken all of our attention, all of our focus, is to really demonstrate that, you know, everything I'm kind of saying and preaching on this podcast can actually be achieved and done. So that's kind of where the focus is just getting the heads down and doing that work. And then if we can achieve that, the UK is obviously the obvious. So we're about to launch in the UK. We've done some soft launches and we have active trials there with UK partners. We're looking at Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Canada, and the US as well, and having conversations with demand from partners there. So we're kind of in the space now of that first step of really leveraging the support and the investment we've gotten to scale the model using what we have right now. And then secondly, to take that and be able to take it to other marketplaces and scale there. And fundamentally, I think if we can achieve that, we put ourselves in the best position possible, because it means, firstly, we have something that's growing very rapidly. And then secondly, we have something we can point to and say, this is what we did here in Ireland and in the UK. And if we can do it there now as well, if you want to be our partner, or if you want to help us, if you want to give us the money to help us do it there. So it's kind of trying to put ourselves in the best of both worlds by just putting the head down and getting to work.
Ronan O'Dolig, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks a million.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.